Now this is one of these impractical classes. You know, nobody ever goes through trials. Trial, what's that?
Yeah.
Job just in a class all his own, I guess. Just the only one. Praise the Lord. No, actually what we're going to do in Bible college, we're going to make it a requirement. You have to take it eight times. I'm going to teach it every semester. You have to take it every semester. By the time Bible college is over, you've had it eight times. Maybe we'll cut it down to four times. Once a year. All right, chapter 30. We just began chapter 30. And in chapter 29, Job remembered his former blessings. And as I pointed out, it was a beautiful representation of the man-child, of a company of people in the last days that have come unto perfection. And that's before the trial. That's before the trial. That's before the suffering. Perfection before the suffering. Don't forget that. That's what God's doing. He's purging out a people, getting them ready before the fire really gets turned on. In other words, brethren, we ain't seen nothing yet. This is judgment and mercy that we're going through now. This is God purging out His people so that we can stand the times later. You know. But anyway, man, God is so good. He is so good to us. But the remembrance of His former blessing makes the reality of His present situation all the more painful. And so in chapter 30, he's really going through the horror of his separation from God. And it's just like Christ. It's a type of Jesus Christ. Because the horror of Christ's separation from His Father is accentuated because of His previous unbroken fellowship. We read in Psalm 88 about the darkness and the horror of separation from God. It goes way beyond David. I mean, way beyond David writing that. That's Christ. That's Christ. Because of His fellowship with His Father. All right. Now, let's go through it. Verses 1 through 10 show him, show that the young men, the young children, the age of his own children, are railing on him now. Verse 1. But now they that are younger than I have me in derision, whose fathers I would have disdained to have set with the dogs of my flock. I mean, their fathers, he wouldn't even have had them work for him. Now their children rail on him. Yea, whereto might the strength of their hands profit me, in whom old age was perished? For want and famine they were solitary, fleeing into the wilderness in former time, desolate and waste. Now he's talking about these fathers of these children that are now persecuting him. For want and famine they were solitary, fleeing into the wilderness in former time, desolate and waste. These men were truly destitute, who cut up mallows by the bushes and juniper roots for their meat. In other words, they ate the very poorest of food. And this mallows by the bushes is literally salt wort among the marsh reeds. And it's a salty tasting plant used as vegetable by the very poorest of people. Now, I don't know if you can catch this. Pardon?
I was wondering if you'd repeat that.
Sure. It's salt wort among the marsh reeds, which is a salty tasting plant used as vegetable by the very poorest. And if you'll notice, we're coming into a description that seems to go way beyond the fathers of these children that are persecuting him. It sounds just like demons. Sounds just like demons. And I'm telling you that that's where that persecution comes from. It's demonic pressure, demonic force, demonic power. Do you know that Paul had a thorn in the flesh and it was a demon? A messenger of Satan sent to buffet me. Continually buffet me. Why was that there? Keep him humble. Job is now under affliction. What is it there for? It's bringing him into greater humility. That's what we're going to see, the end result. Sometimes these demons have a way of humbling us down, huh? All right, so we see how they're driven into dry places, and they're feeding on the very foulest of food. Verse 5, they were driven forth from among men. They cried after them as after a thief. They are, they're thieves. They're viler than all mankind. Even the unclean hate them. Even the heathen don't like demons, basically, when they know what they are. To dwell in the cliffs of the valleys, in caves of the earth, and in the rocks. That's right, in dark places. Among the bushes they brayed, under the nettles they were gathered together. I mean, the very vilest of situations. There's no home. It's darkness and dryness and desolation. I mean, it sounds just like demons. They were children of fools, yea, children of base men. They were viler than the earth. That's right. They are viler than the earth. They are more vile than any man that's ever been created. And now am I their song. Yea, I am their byword. In other words, I am now the brunt of their hatred and their mockery. It sounds like Jesus on the cross. And it's going to be like the persecution against the man-child company, too. They abhor me, they flee far from me, and spare not to spit in my face. Now, that could be a possibility of actually happening to Job. But it's probably not. It probably did not do that. It's probably a representation, a pointing out of their hatred and despite, their spite towards him. It's probably poetic. And, of course, also prophetic. Prophetic of what happened to Jesus Christ. Verse 11. Because he has loosed my cord and afflicted me, they have also let loose the bridle before me. This is really interesting. Loosed my cord, it undoubtedly speaks of a bow string. And in chapter 29 and verse 20, it says, my glory was fresh in me and my bow was renewed in my hand. The bow represented the power and the authority. The bow was in his hand. And he loosed the cord. Meaning, he loosed the bowstring so that Job no longer had any power or authority. He was no longer able to strike down his enemies. And this affliction emboldened those that were far beneath him and those who had a distorted character, and they used it as an opportunity to persecute him. When he was at a point of weakness, they used it as the time to jump on him. Like Christ, we said nothing, you know. He just gave himself up. That's the time they pushed upon him to destroy him. The time of weakness. Isn't that what the devil does? He waits until the Lord takes away your own strength, and then he rushes in to try to down you. And that's the time when you got to call on God and trust in him for strength. Yes, Paul?
Why were these men persecuting Job? I mean, he had been a friend of the fatherless and the widow and the needy. Why were they so...
They hated attitude. You know, it's like the lowly always look for a chance. They're always resentful for those that are above them. They're always resentful. So if they get knocked down, they're ready to take advantage of them. And, you know, there's this guy in high school that his last name was Gross. Can't remember his first name now, but he always got picked on. This guy always got picked on. I saw him get beat up more times. I felt sorry for the guy. I really did. And I'd always try to be nice to him. But I found out one of the reasons why he was so disliked. You know, I never really... Steve Gross, that's what his name was. And I never was around him much. I mean, he was really a vile guy. After I got saved and went back to my hometown, I witnessed to him among other guys, and he just would have nothing to do with it, kind of just really, really a vile character. And he had a horrible upbringing. And but one time after football practice, I caught a kickoff in practice, and I went into this whole crowd of guys. You know, what am I going to do? So I just put down my head and just ran. And they told me later that three guys hit me all at the same time. Anyway, it hit so hard that I went into amnesia. I just forgot everything. I just didn't know where I was. I didn't know what I was doing. I was still able, my body was still fine, but I just forgot everything. Some of them wondered, are you all right, Mark? You know, I just was dazed. I didn't know what the plays were. They had to kind of tell me what to do. Here, you run over here and tackle this guy. You go over there and do that. And I slowly regained it back. But after football practice, I still didn't know. And I was changing pipes at the time. So after football practice, we go out and change pipes. And they had to kind of tell me what to do. And the guys that I was going with had to kind of take me along. And at that time, this guy sat down and he saw what was happening. And I kept asking questions, what did I do last night? And he started telling me I did things that were really horrible. And the impact on me was, I did? Because, see, I couldn't remember. And I remember that later. He took advantage of me at a real low point. And it kind of put a fear in me, you know, a little bit of a fear in there. And he used that, see, to get me, you know. And I'd never done anything against him. And I still felt sorry for him after that. Still felt sorry for him. But I began to see that vile character coming out, you know. And he'd be one that'd pick on little kids, you know. He'd kind of like to be the bully over little kids. So he just felt so bad for the guy. I mean, it was just really... See, same thing. Same thing. Just like demons. Just like demons. Catch you at an opportune season. Catch you at a weak moment. And then get you. See, try to hurt you. And that's what these were like. And, you know, it's like what happened in New York when the lights went out. All the poor people ransacked all the rich homes. They're upset that they're rich. They don't like it that they're rich. You know? They shouldn't be rich. why are they rich? You know, I mean, there's reasons. But anyway, these are demons. Okay, verse 12. Upon my right hand rise the youth. They push away my feet, and they raise up against me the ways of their destruction. The very things they do are going to become their destruction. This word youth is more literally rabble. Rabble. And it's used for vagabonds or rascals. It generally does carry the idea of younger ones. They push away my feet. That is, they reject my manner of life. They despise any previous judgments that I've made or had. They despise the very least of my person. And the things that they do against me are the things that will be their destruction ultimately. And isn't that the way it is with demons? I mean, this is the way it is with demons. Don't they mock and revile all of your manner of life? They despise it, don't they? Verse 13. They mar my path. They set forward my calamity. They have no helper. And they do in and of themselves, in other words, it's their own hatred, it's their own wickedness that is causing them to destroy me. Verse 14, they came upon me as a wide breaking in of waters, and the desolation they rolled themselves upon me. And add to that, verse 15, terrors are turned upon me, they pursue my soul as a wind, and my welfare passes away as a cloud. It kind of gives the idea of an onrushing army seeking to storm and to seize this city. Now, this is clearly reaching beyond Job. It's got to be reaching beyond Job. We're talking about what Jesus went through. Do you realize the torments and the terrors of soul that he went through as the demons rushed in upon him? Demons were rushing upon Christ. Rushing. You know, he almost died in the Garden of Gethsemane? When he made that decision, you know, it was a hard decision to make. Do you know the pressure pounding in his head to try to get him to say no, 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 and call for 12 legions of angels? I mean, he was under pressure. Do you know why he sweat great drops of blood? You'll only do that when you are under such great duress and stress you're about ready to die. People that have that usually go into shock. And it's even been known to be fatal. Because the pressure, you know how if somebody gets really angry, how blood just rushes to the face and the pressure on the head. See, I've seen people like that. I don't think I've ever experienced that myself, but I've seen others that get really angry and something just races up into them. Maybe I did experience it once. I had a dog in heat in the backyard, and I was going to breed it and sell the pups because it was a particular thing. This was years ago. And there was a little dog next door that kept getting through my fence. I about killed that thing. He made me so mad because I blocked everything off and that dog found a way to get through. And he never did. He never did make it. But I tell you, I about killed him. I got mad. I couldn't believe how I got mad. I was surprised how mad I got. There's a dog, and I could feel the blood rush into my face, you know. You know. And my wife remembers that. That was a frustrating thing to me. And I don't think I've never been mad like that at people. I don't think ever in my life. But that dog, I tell you, I just about killed the thing. And unclean mutt. I mean, it was a mutt, you know. Anyway, you know the pressure, the blood rushes, the veins press out. People can have heart attacks when they go through things like that. I mean, it just, you know. And people in great fear or torture, you know, you can practically, the pressure is so great. You know, it's amazing how emotions affect the heart like that and affect the blood system like that. You know, you think, well, what connection is there between the two? It's really closely connected. And Jesus, I'm trying to point out the strain that he must have been under to cause the capillaries to burst in the skin and to mix blood with sweat. You know how you're really nervous, you start sweating even when you're not hot? Add that about 50 times over. Tremendous strain and pressure so that your capillaries actually burst. I mean, that's really something. That's really something. And causing blood to mix with the sweat. That's where Jesus was. He was under such torments, pressure. You know the demons were on him. I mean, the demonic pressure was just extreme. Mm-hmm. Trying to force him, don't go to the cross. Don't go to the cross, you know. You don't have to die. You don't have to die, you know. It's the same pressure that comes upon you when, get back at him. Don't just die to self. Get back at him, you know. Mm-hmm. Yell back. Fight back, you know. Take advantage. You deserve it, you know. Pressure from demons, and I'm sure this is what is being described. Now, like you asked, I'm going to answer, how could Job be so ridiculed by these young men? What was it? There's an answer that's given in Kyle and Dillich that may be right. And I'm just going to give it to you and paint a picture for you. We know that Job sat down in ashes. And because of his affliction, he undoubtedly was separate from people. And his acquaintances stood afar off. So we know he was alone. And his disease and his uncleanness would have caused him to be separated from his people around him. Kyle and Dillich feels that possibly Job sat upon the ashes in the city's dung dump. The ashes of the city's dung dump. Now what's the city's dung dump? It's called a Mezbele. Mezbele. What it is the animals stayed in the city generally. Many of them live right in the homes. And as they'd clear out their homes, it's hot, hot, dry climate. They would take the dung and they'd take it out to a pile outside the city and they'd throw it on the pile. And regularly they would burn it. You've heard of buffalo chips? I tell you, they are fantastic fires. Really, cow pies, those of you who've been around, cow pies, we used to ride horses sometimes out in the pasture and you'd fall on a cow pie and you'd bust your head open. Those things are hard as rocks. How many of you know what I'm talking about? They dry up live, you are farm boys, girls, and make beautiful fires. Because what it is all the moisture dries out and all that's left is the roughage from the animal's diet. The roughage. And it's fine and it burns really well. And so they'd take it out there and it'd dry really fast and they'd burn it and it would leave ashes. It'd leave a lot of ashes. And generally burned once a month. And it would build up over the years. Now these ashes would get rained on during the rainy season. And you know what rain does to ashes? It can turn it into a hard clay. It can, depending on, you know, what's been burned. But it can turn it into a hard clay. And so what would happen is these dung dumps would get higher and higher and higher over the years. And pretty soon they'd get to big mounds bigger than the homes. And oftentimes they would actually hollow these things out, and they were very hard, and they were waterproof. And they would hollow them out, and they'd use them for granaries. Hmm. And then they'd start new piles. And I've seen pictures of them, and I'd see pictures outside of old villages that have been around for centuries. They'd have four or five of these mezbelas, built up, you know, and then now hollowed out and used as granaries. And of course, they're working on another one over here that they threw out the animal's dung and burned it, so forth. Now, this area was an area where beggars often would frequent, or unclean persons. And it would be outside the city, usually by one of the main roads. And so the beggars would stay there. The unclean people would frequent there. They'd ask for alms by the passerbys. And and sometimes people would even sleep on these mounds at night. And a wandering bands of vagabonds would find a great sport in seeing this most rich man of the East, now reduced to a beggar position, sitting on the dung dump of the city, out on one of the mezbalas among the ashes, because it'd be softer for his body. You know, until it rained on it, of course, but it'd be soft for his body. And so it may be this rich chieftain who was over all these other families now is sitting out on the dung dump. They would find great sport in that. Take advantage of it. See, that's possibly the case. Can't prove it, but it's a possibility. Okay, so he continues to mourn his condition. Verse 16. And now my soul is poured out upon me. The days of affliction have taken hold upon me. My bones are pierced in me in the night season, and my sinews take no rest. His soul is poured out because he's expressing complaint all the time. And there's no life in it. And his bones are pierced within him. The bones represent the inner man. And he's experiencing the pain of his situation very deeply to the bone. And at the nighttime is especially when the pain is fiercest, because it's a time of quiet and there's nothing to distract you from the pain. When you're really in pain, the nighttime is the hardest time to bear. Nighttime is also when the enemies attack. And that's when the enemies are attacking. That is the demons and these spiritual forces against his soul. That's when the Satan comes against the inner man, when you're in a time of great pain and quiet and there's no other distraction. The devil can come in there with these clear temptations to try to pressure you, force you. So also Christ in Psalms 22 and verse 20, his bones burned within him. Verse 18. By the great force of my disease is my garment changed. It binds me about as a collar of my coat. And having on sackcloth and sitting in ashes, he was bound about in that, but also figuratively, the affliction was a binding thing to him, a pressure round about him. He hath cast me into the mire, and I am become like dust and ashes. I cry unto thee, and thou dost not hear me. I stand up, and thou regardest me not. Notice how he changed from the third person to the first person. He, God, has cast me down into the mire. I am as dust. I'm as nothing. As dirt. No better than death. And then look at, he turns into prayer. I cry unto thee, and thou dost not hear me. The torments of his soul have taken him away from his situation again, and now he's looking to the Lord. He's crying out to God personally. He's saying, you don't hear me. You're not listening to me. Thou art become cruel to me. With thy strong hand thou oppressest thyself against me. See, that's the way he viewed it. And Jesus Christ was smitten of God. He was. He was smitten of God. He was judged of God. He was cast off by God. God made him to be sin. It did happen, you know. Verse 22, thou liftest me up to the wind. Thou causest me to ride upon it and dissolvest my substance. It's pointing out that he was given over to another power. He had no control. None. He was given over to another power, just cast upon the wind. He'd be driven wherever he would. Verse 23. For I know that thou wilt bring me to death and to the house appointed for all living. See, again, notice Job's fear was because of a fear of separation from God. You might ask, well, what happened to the revelation that he had back in chapter 19? My Redeemer liveth, and I shall see him, not another. I shall see him for myself. What happened to that revelation? Well, see, this is a different. There's a different reason for this. This is a different aspect of Christ. He's viewing now, at that time, he saw the revelation of how God would be for him. Now all he's viewing is separation from God because that's all he knows. Sometimes we go through that too, don't we? Seeing different aspects of a trial, of affliction. You see the promise of it, but then the present circumstances of it. You know, you go through different aspects. But here it's pointing to the death. In chapter 19, it was pointing to the resurrection of Christ. Here is the death of Christ. Job, we can see here, did not look for a restoration in this life before death either. He wasn't planning on that. He had no hope of that. Obviously, the hope in chapter 19 was a hope of resurrection after death. Because that's all he had. Yes?
What's that phrase mean? The house appointed for all living?
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
It's death.
It's where everybody goes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's just figurative of Sheol.
Okay.
Yeah. That's the house appointed for all living, Sheol. Verse 24. Howbeit he will not stretch out his hand to the grave, though they cry in his destruction. Better translation is as seen in the Thompson Chain margin. Can I use yours for a second? Thompson Chain margin says for this verse, verse 24, it says, howbeit doth not one stretch out the hand in his fall, or in his calamity cry for help? Which one of you, when you fall, just go fall down flat first, hit your nose first? You always put your hand out. And so basically what he's saying, you want to condemn me for crying out for pain? Who doesn't? You want to condemn me for complaining in my calamity? Who doesn't? You fall, don't you stretch out your hand to catch it? That's what I'm doing. That's all I'm doing. So, and it's a wisdom here to cry out to God and to rely on God. That's the only hope he had. Soon, Job is going to be able to relate to Psalm 18, 1 through 6. I will love Thee, O Lord, my strength. The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God, my strength in whom I will trust, my buckler and the horn of my salvation, my high tower. I will call upon the Lord who is worthy to be praised. So shall I be saved from mine enemies. The sorrows of death compassed me, and the floods of ungodly men made me afraid. The sorrows of hell compassed me about, the snares of death prevented me. In my distress I called upon the Lord and cried unto my God. He heard my voice out of his temple, and my cry came before him even into his ears. Eventually he's going to be able to say that. He can't write yet. He hasn't been heard yet. I'll tell you, brethren, don't give up. It doesn't matter how dark it is. You know how they say it's darkest before the dawn? God, how come you don't hear me? He hears you.
Amen.
He hears you. The Calvary's coming. Trust. Have confidence. Be patient. You're still alive. You haven't resisted unto blood. You know? You're still breathing. Okay. Verse 25. How did not I weep for him that was in trouble? Was not my soul grieved for the poor? In other words, didn't I have the right attitude? But although it doesn't seem to help me now. Verse 26, when I looked for good, then evil came unto me. And when I waited for light, there came darkness. See, I did all these things right, and I suspected I'd be blessed for it, but look what happened. My bowels boiled and rested not. The days of affliction prevented me. I went mourning without the sun. I stood up and I cried in the congregation. I went mourning. Literally, I went blackened. Blackened. And it was without the sun. See, the sun would make you black in that land. He said, I went blackened, but not with the sun. In other words, I was blackened by the wrath of God. God's wrath blackened me. That's awful. And I went and I cried in the congregation. Either he's meaning that those that were listening to him and casting judgment on him, he cried out in front of them. Or he might be figuratively speaking of that courtroom that he talked about. He said, boy, if I could just come into the courtroom, I'd talk to God and I'd tell him what I wanted and I'd say this and that and my judge would come up and rise up for me. Remember? He might be figuratively talking about that. Verse 29, I am a brother to dragons and a companion to owls. Dragons is probably jackals who cry in the middle of the night. Owls is probably ostriches who live out in desolate habitations. It's talking about those that live in darkness and in desolate desert regions. So that's where he is. He's in desolation. And it often carries the idea also of demons as being those that wander in dry places. Now I've become like one of them. My skin is black upon me and my bones are burned with heat. In other words, all outward appearance and all inner feeling is utterly inflamed with torture. Outwardly and inwardly, utterly inflamed with torture. My harp also is turned to mourning, and my organ into the voice of them that weep. In other words, everything that should be joy is now sorrow. All that should be joy is sorrow. And it sounds very similar to Psalm 102, verses 1 through 6. Psalm 102, verses 1 through 6. All the sorrow that has come upon him. Now, chapter 31. Even though he just complained, chapter 31, guess what he does? He repudiates all iniquity. He exhibits his righteousness. And he ends up with a final cry that he might meet God and be vindicated. And that sets the stage for Elihu in chapter 32. So again, he finishes up by repudiating all iniquity, exhibits his righteousness, and he ends up with a final cry that he might meet God and be finally and fully vindicated. That's his desire. So, verse 1. I made a covenant with mine eyes. Why then should I think upon a maid? This is an interesting revelation that Job had. Clearly stated later by Christ in Matthew 5:28, if a man looks upon a woman to lust after her, he has committed adultery in his heart. He's committed adultery in his heart. Notice how the eyes and the heart go together, the eyes and the mind. The eyes and the mind, what you look at is what you think about. In fact, it's interesting, but the word think here is literally gaze. I made a covenant with mine eyes. Why then should I gaze upon a maid? And if you're gazing, you're obviously pondering and thinking. What do we see Job is doing? Job's love for God was greater than his natural than he would allow his natural desire to replace. He would not allow natural desire to replace his love for God. He feared God's retribution. And he here is openly requesting it, if such was the case. He basically, in chapter 31, is saying, if I have done all these things, then let me be judged. But I haven't, so why am I being judged? If I've done them, then let me be judged. See, he still doesn't have the revelation of perfection through suffering. Doesn't have it yet. Fully. Got glimpses of it, but doesn't see it fully. Many men should make the same covenant. Watch what your eyes look at. Watch your eyes. Don't let pictures into your mind. You know, eyes take pictures. Don't let the wrong pictures enter into your mind. You know, you can look at people different ways, various ways. Look at them. To one person who looks at them and sees something completely different than when somebody else looks at them. Now, when you're in the Spirit, you're worshiping before the Lord, are you in a pure, holy realm? And the expression is pure and holy and it's godly. But if you're judging it carnally, that's not what you see. You know, you don't see that and you're judging it carnally. And like Pastor Don so succinctly described the other night, he said, you know, I understand. He said, here I am telling people what to do and what not to do, and then I go out and do the very same thing. It's totally pure to me and I know it. You know, I'm in the Spirit and everything, but I look at the other, you know, I look at it and I wonder. I know what I'm doing is wonderful and fine and right before God, but then I look at this person over here, I'm not so sure about them. So you can't judge it from the outward. And it's just a good old smash to our legalism. Forcing us to trust our brother. Forcing us to get out of that legalistic mode. You know, hedge about the law. If you do this, you're righteous. If you don't, you're not. You know. Or if you don't do this, you're righteous. And if you do do it, you're not righteous. Because it goes much deeper than that. And see, that's the law that Jesus was trying to instill into the hearts of his people. Is it's inside. It's inside. And so don't judge the outward. Don't judge. And so those that others would judge harshly, he said, they're the first ones to enter in the kingdom of heaven. Harlots and publicans enter the kingdom of heaven before the rest of them. Okay, anyway. So this is the covenant that Job made, and I suggest all you men make the same covenant. Verse 2, for what portion of God is there from above? What inheritance of the Almighty from on high? In other words, if I did think upon that maid, if I did commit adultery in my heart, what is God going to do with that? Verse 3, is it not destruction to the wicked and a strange punishment to the workers of iniquity? Isn't he going to judge that attitude? You bet he is. You bet he is. Doth not he see my ways and count all my steps? If I have walked with vanity or if my foot is hasted to deceit, let me be weighed in an even balance that God may know my integrity. Now he's saying something that in one sense is good, in another sense is not so wise. He's basically saying that I have not done these things. I have not walked in vanity. If I have, let me be weighed in an even balance. The revelation, though, on the other hand, is that if God marks iniquities, who can stand? And even though his heart has been right, if God judged every little thing, we'd be in real trouble. That's why Job did have the revelation, we know. We know he did. He had the revelation that God judges his heart. And therefore, since his heart was after God, and he was committed to God in his heart, there was a peace and a trusting. There was a righteousness in him because he knew his heart was right. Therefore, there was no condemnation to Job. If my step is turned out of the way and mine heart walked after mine eyes, notice again there, his heart walking after his eyes. You know, the lust of the eyes is very easily experienced. You need to be very careful not to let the intent of the heart follow. You need to be very careful. Watch what you look at. Watch your eyes. If my heart walked after mine eyes, and if any blot has cleaved to my hands, then let me sow and let another eat. Yea, let my offspring be rooted out. In other words, go ahead and judge me if that's what I've done. But I haven't done that. Verse 9, if mine heart have been deceived by a woman, or if I have laid wait at my neighbor's door, then let my wife grind into another. That is, let her become his wife and make his bread, and let others bow down upon her. In other words, the physical union. For this is a heinous crime, yea, it is an iniquity to be punished by the judges. For it is a fire that consumes to destruction and would root out all mine increase. He had quite an interesting revelation here. This whole first 12 verses deals with the destruction of lust, particularly as seen in sexual lust. And it's a cause of corruption in the world. We'll see that in Proverbs also. How the man that commits adultery does not go unpunished. It's going to affect him. It's going to harm him, hurt him. Verse 13, if I did despise the cause of my manservant or of my maidservant when they contended with me, what then shall I do when God rises up and when He visits? What shall I answer Him? See, he recognized, I've got men servants and maidservants, but I'm also God's maidservant. So if I treat my manservant wrong, how's he going to treat me? He says, what am I going to do when he rises up? He had the revelation of what you sow, you shall also reap. He had that revelation, so he was careful. He showed others mercy so that God would show him mercy. Verse 15, did not he that made me in the womb make him? Did not one fashion us in the womb? This is also another wonderful revelation. For a man that had such a high position over other people, he did not squander it. He was not a tyrant. He knew that all stood the same, equal before God. That's quite a revelation. Especially back at that time when you had slaves and others. All stood equal before God. All had infinite worth and infinite value before God. Verse 16. If I have withheld the poor from their desire, or have caused the eyes of the widow to fail, or have eaten my morsel myself alone, and the fatherless has not eaten thereof, for from my youth he was brought up with me as with the father, and I have guided her from my mother's womb. In other words, both the fatherless and the widow. If I have seen any perish for want of clothing, or any poor without covering, if his loins have not blessed me, if he were not warmed with the fleece of my sheep, if I have lifted up my hand against the fatherless when I saw my help in the gate, then let mine arm fall from my shoulder blade, and mine arm be broken from the bone. In other words, he's saying, let's just be fair. If I have not been fair, and if I have not loved and cared for others, fine, destroy me. Then I want it. Then I want to be judged. But, see, this thing was such a fear to him, he would never let the fatherless go without clothing. He would never let the widow go without help. And so he was constantly looking out for the poor of the land. And the reason why he did all of that is because of verse 23. For destruction from God was a terror to me, and by reason of His highness I could not endure. Oh, would to God that every Christian felt the same way. Would to God that every Christian that even got a thought in his mind of divorce would immediately have his knees begin to shake.
Right.
His teeth begin to rattle in his mouth. And out of fear of it, he would cast the thing so quickly from his mind that he'd... You know, it's like contraband. You know, if you get caught with it, you're thrown into jail. You find that thing and you see it, you cast it from your hand like a hot potato. You wouldn't dare hold it in your hand. You don't want any part of it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want any part of it. You don't dare get caught. Because destruction from God should be a terror to you.
Yes.
By reason of His highness, when you see how high He is, you should not be able to endure.
Yes.
You should fall down on your face and say, God, I will never go against Your will. How dare I? Whatever You say goes. This man feared backsliding. He feared going against God's will. And that's the fear we need to have.
Yes.
Yes.
That's what kept him in that righteous place. That's one of the things. He also loved God. He also saw Him as for Him and on His side. That was able to keep him out of legalism. The legalism of false judgment like these others fell into. Just like Hebrews 5 and verse 7, Jesus Christ was heard in that He feared. In that He had a godly fear. He was heard. Because He had a godly fear. Verse 24. If I have made gold my hope, or have said to the fine gold, Thou art my confidence, if I have rejoiced because my wealth was great, because mine hand had gotten much, if I beheld the sun when it shined, or the moon walking in brightness, and my heart had been secretly enticed, or my mouth had kissed my hand, this also were an iniquity to be punished by the judge, for I should have denied the God that is above. Basically, he's saying that if I lusted after riches, or if I allowed my high position to bring me into pride, and to a worship of heavenly bodies, you know, the sun, the moon, the stars. And by the way, that was often fallen into by people in that day. They worshiped the heavens. Israel also fell into that sin often, worshiping of the heavens. He says, if I have done that, then I'll be judged. I would have denied God that is above. Verse 29, if I rejoice at the destruction of him that hated me, or lifted up myself when evil found him, neither have I suffered my mouth to sin by wishing a curse to his soul. If the men of my tabernacle said not, oh, that we had of his flesh, we cannot be satisfied. He's basically saying here, if I have had any negative attitude against my enemies, then let God judge me. This brother really had a noble spirit, like King David. King David knew that he could not come against his enemies. He said, God's going to have to thrust him down, not me. He would not kill Saul. He would not take advantage. Even Shimei. Remember Shimei who cursed him? He said, the Lord is using him to curse me. We'll just leave him go. We'll just leave him go. But he later told him, he says, you leave Jerusalem and you're a dead man. He said, because you've cursed me like this, you've got to stay in the rock. You step out of the rock and that sin is going to come on your head. And it did. He was killed, I think, by Solomon. Isn't that right? So the stranger did not lodge in the street, but I opened my doors to the traveler. He says in verse 32. Verse 33, if I covered my transgressions as Adam by hiding mine iniquity in my bosom. Interesting statement. How did he know? Moses hadn't lived yet. He hadn't written the Pentateuch yet. Undoubtedly, by spoken tradition, it's possible there were also some writings. Realize, though, that Job may have talked to, may have gotten the story of Adam third hand. Because Adam lived till Methuselah, and Methuselah lived till the flood. And lived until Shem, and Shem lived probably to the time of Job. Shem lived, 120 years or so after the birth of Abraham. So Shem and Abraham were contemporaries. Shem went through the flood. Shem knew Methuselah, maybe knew Methuselah, you know, I'm just supposing, who maybe knew Adam. So that means that Job could have received third hand about Adam. You know? And realizing the integrity level in people in that day, when they passed things down, they didn't embellish the story. It was part of the. It was a very important part of their tradition and of their honor that they be careful to pass it down properly. Now, of course, Moses, he got his revelation from God, so no matter what he'd heard, it came out clear under the revelation of him in his pen. But they knew that Adam hid his transgressions. Adam probably told the story many times, how he hid himself in the garden after eating the tree, the knowledge of good and evil. Okay, let's go on now. So he's saying, I'm not hiding my sin. Verse 34. Did I fear a great multitude, or did the contempt of families terrify me that I kept silence and went not out of the door? In other words, was I in the fear of man? Was I intimidated by people? This is because of verse 33 being just before this. It's possibly also pointing to the idea that if he had sins that were known openly, did he fear repenting? Did he fear coming to them and making it right? No. Verse 35. Oh, that one would hear me. Behold, my desire is that the Almighty would answer me. And that mine adversary had written a book. Why do you want his adversary to write a book? Because he's saying that, certainly, I am being judged of God. But what for? I'd like to know why. I'd like to weigh that book in the balance of my righteousness. Because it just doesn't make sense. I have not done any of these things. I have not allowed them to be a part of my life. Now see, he's spending all his breath justifying himself, you notice? When he gets done, he's not going to have any breath left to justify himself. Was he wrong in his assessment? No, he was not wrong. He was righteous. He didn't deserve it. You know, you can be right and yet be wrong because of the emphasis. You can be teaching right doctrine but be wrong because of the emphasis. You can be right in your judgment of a situation but be wrong because of the emphasis you place on it. He was right in that he was just, but he was wrong in that he emphasized his justice, his righteousness. He should have been emphasizing God's righteousness. You know, you can talk a thing over with somebody and be right in your discussion, and yet because of the emphasis, or because of even saying anything at all, be wrong. Then better not to even talk about it. Just justify God. Just honor God. Just honor God. My wife and I have been learning, God has really been teaching us in this movie, really teaching us what it really means not to judge. It's not that we've been critics all our life. We haven't been. We haven't been critical. But to not to judge. Not to even judge. Not to even assess it. Just forget it. You know, the Lord's trying to teach us all to do that.
Yeah.
It's one of those wicked roots of legalism.
Yeah.
You might have enough integrity so you don't do anything with your judgment. But the fact that you spent the time judging at all could be your error. Even though you were right in your assessment. Should have just forgotten it and spent that time. Imagine if you spent that time speaking the Word of God, edifying one another, exhorting one another, praising God. What if that time would have been spent praising? The other wasn't wrong, but it was wrong. Because it took up time and put a focus on a thing that shouldn't have been focused on. But I'm righteous. Yeah, I know you're righteous, but you spend all your time justifying yourself instead of justifying God. No.
Martin,
yes?
Wouldn't that even go to the point where you started to indict God? I mean, more than just justifying yourself. By justifying yourself so much, so often, for so long, people would tend to start blaming and indicting evil to God.
Yes. Oh, yeah. If they could take on the same thing. Boy, God must really be, you know. Yeah, after a while, it can kind of get people, yeah, you really must be righteous. Must be something wrong with God then. And see, that's the thing. He knew there was nothing wrong with God, but he couldn't help but think that God had made him his enemy. And so, you know, I mean, he's in confusion. He didn't know. And he knew he was righteous, and so he just laid himself on that. He should have honked his horn. He should have laid himself on the horn of God is righteous. And I don't know what all this is, but God is righteous. And maintained those certain revelations he got throughout his speeches. I'll come forth as gold. I shall see my Redeemer. He should have laid all his emphasis on those. Okay. Verse 36. Surely I would take it upon my shoulder, that is, this book that my adversary wrote, and bind it as a crown to me, and I declare unto him the number of my steps as a prince when I go near unto him. In other words, instead of all this nebulousness, and he doesn't know what he did wrong, he would rather have a list of all that he did wrong. Do you know why? And you know why that was a confident thing to him? You know why he'd bind it upon his shoulder? Because he knew that since his heart was right before God, and that he desired to please God, that if he knew his sins, he would take them before the Lord, and he would trust the Lord for forgiveness, and then he'd be delivered from this thing. But he didn't know what was the problem. You know, you need to have the same confidence. You need to have the same. You should be able to look at your sins square in the eye and say, I'm still righteous in Christ. I'm still righteous in Christ because the good that I would, I do not. The evil that I would not, that I do. And so it's not like I want to. I don't. That's why it hurts so bad. That's why people get condemned, because they don't want to. Well, the Bible says you don't get condemned. Of course you don't want to. Good that you would, you do not. So trust in the righteousness of Jesus Christ and become spiritually minded. That's the answer. Don't walk in condemnation. Become spiritually minded. Walk after the things of the Spirit. Be a debtor to the Spirit. Trust in what Jesus has done, not what you have done. And let that be your emphasis. Back to Romans 8 again. And I would declare unto him the number of my steps. As a prince would I go near unto him. Verse 38. If my land cry against me, or that the furrows likewise thereof complain, if I have eaten the fruits thereof without money, or have caused the owners thereof to lose their life. In other words, those that I have lent out land to, and I've had them work my land, and then I've paid them for it. If I have not paid them properly, then let thistles grow instead of wheat and cockle instead of barley. The words of Job are in it. And of course, they're not going to do that. See, Job could handle just retribution, but he couldn't handle what he was going through. He could handle just punishment. He could take it. He'd say, I've done it. Judgment. But he couldn't handle this. Therefore, as Elihu says, he has to be tried to the very end. Job, you're going to have to be tested to the very end to bring you to a place of patience and full committal to God and a complete glorifying of God and not yourself without complaint. Did you get that? Let me read that again. Because this is where you and I have to come to. Because Job could not handle this, therefore, as Elihu is going to declare, he must be tried to the very end, tested to the very end, in order to learn patience and to fully commit himself to glorifying God and not himself. To glorifying God and not himself without complaint.